This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in the American West, a channel on the New Books Network of podcasts. I'm Stephen Hausman. I'm an assistant professor in the history department at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota, and I'm your host for today's interview. I'm very excited to welcome Damon B. Akins and William J. Bauer Jr. to the show. Dr. Akins is an associate professor of history at Guilford College, and Dr. Bauer is a professor of history at the University of Nevada at Las Vegas. And together, they are the co-authors of We Are the Land, a history of Native California, which came out earlier this year in 2021 from the University of California Press. Welcome, both of you, to the New Books Network.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Why don't we begin by just hearing a bit about yourselves and your backgrounds? How did each of you become interested in history, and why did you and how did you become professional historians? And Willie, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, sure. So I'm an enrolled citizen of the Round Valley Indian Tribes, which is located in Northern California. So our reservation is about 180 miles north of San Francisco off of Highway 101. And so when I was an undergraduate, I went to an institution that had, I think, a grand total of three classes on American Indian content. That was American Indian history, American Indian government, and American Indian literature. And so kind of reflecting on that experience as I was about to kind of graduate undergraduate, I thought it was important to have people kind of enter the historical profession, kind of to teach classes on kind of more on American Indian history in general. In terms of kind of the research focus, I always wanted to kind of write about home. So my first kind of book was a history of migrant workers in Northern California based out of the Round Valley Reservation. So I've always been kind of deeply interested in kind of rethinking and kind of discussing historically kind of the experiences of indigenous peoples in California.
I'll jump in and say my story is very different than Willie's, but share some overall similar patterns. I grew up in Oklahoma, which is Indian country, Indian territory. So I grew up surrounded in a way that it was probably rather uncommon at the time, surrounded by indigenous culture. But to be honest, as a young person, that was not something that I was motivated into looking into. It was something that was kind of I don't know, it was just sort of there. So I left, as many people do, to get away and study things that were far away, and was interested in art. Realized very quickly that my interest in art was really an interest in art history, because I'm not talented. And then it went from being art history, I realized that the thing that I was actually interested in was just the history part. And then one day read Gabriel Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude in the student union by the fireplace on a winter day and decided I needed to study Latin America. So I studied Latin America. That's the direction I took. in California. And once I realized that I was studying Latin America, once I realized that, it was, what was interesting to me was questions of nationalism and ethnic identity and sovereignty and how countries are built and how they come together and exclude. And so I realized that those issues that were attracting me to Latin America were also present in California. So here I was in California thinking that I need to study California. So in order to do that, of course, I went back to Oklahoma, where strangely, there were two really phenomenal California historians working at the University of Oklahoma. And I studied with Al Hurtado, as did Willie, did a PhD on Southern California native history from mid-19th century to mid-20th century. And that's how I became a professional historian.
And what about the genesis of this book? How did it come together? And why write a book like this in the first place? How did it come about?
Well, I'll start there. Willie is the genesis of the project. He saw the gap, I think, certainly before I did, but I think he saw the gap early on. The gap meaning that there isn't a book like this. There wasn't before this one, and I think there, for a number of reasons, it's a difficult book to write. But he saw that there needed to be a book that could fill that void, namely that could carry what other scholars had done into the 20th and 21st century, and also provide an accessible, both physically accessible, you can get a hold of it, but also in terms of its writing style and its audience, an accessible history of California that focuses on a native perspective. And he lulled me in with drinks. We were at a conference in Oakland, and he said, "I got an idea." And so we had a couple drinks, and I immediately recognized that he was right, and we jumped on board.
Yeah, I think to kind of build on that and to kind of think through sometimes good and bad decisions made over drinks at the end of a conference.
I'd say this is a good one.
I'm just teasing, of course.
I would agree with that as well.
I think kind of the gap that I think Damon was speaking about is that I think one of the great things about the book is that we were able to kind of build on the kind of a great foundation that was already established by two indigenous scholars. And so in the 1960s, the Lenape scholar Jack Forbes wrote a book called Native Californians, Native Peoples in California and in Nevada, which was a kind of a survey of indigenous peoples in both of those two states. And so it was revised in the 1980s. And then in the 1990s, Cahuilla scholar Rupert Costa also wrote a book called Natives of the Golden State. And those are both really kind of fantastic kind of overviews of California history. But as Damon kind of pointed out, I think we recognize a couple of deficiencies with those texts. One is that they were a bit older, right? So it's hard to get books that were published in the 1980s or even the 1990s. So both of those books have a kind of hard time kind of staying in print. Secondly, they don't, as Damon kind of mentioned, they don't cover the 20th and 21st century with a lot of kind of detail. And so we really wanted to kind of focus in on the 20th and 21st centuries in this book. And we wanted to write something that would be kind of that would reach kind of California Indian people, that they could kind of see their histories, their stories in it. So if we have California Indian people reading the book, they could see a story about their aunt or uncle in it, or they see a picture of a relative in it. I think kind of it's vitally important for, I think, California Indian people to see themselves in the history of California, but also to have something kind of accessible for K-12 educators, especially as there's a tortured kind of relationship about kind of how to teach California history, especially kind of at the fourth grade level. And so providing kind of a resource for K-12 teachers, and then providing a resource for people who teach California history at the California State University system and at the University of California system, is kind of having kind of a book that would be useful for people who teach California history, but to kind of incorporate California Indian content and information.
Yeah, and as I was reading this book, I was thinking about how it could, in many ways, serve as a model for other people wanting to write about specific places, whether states or other localities, from an indigenous perspective. That really, you could transplant the stories here, and obviously be a very different story, but you could write about it in other places as well. So I hope that someone kind of picks up that mantle. And I'm speaking to you now from Oregon, and I could see a similar book like this, but about Oregon and the place that would become Oregon as well.
Yeah, I could definitely see that as well. I think that's the fact that you're in Oregon makes a lot of sense about it, because I think part of what made this book work the way it did is also what made it a difficult book to write. And that is, California had the most diverse indigenous population of probably any region, except perhaps maybe Washington and Oregon, which in some ways those are false boundaries. So we could say the Pacific coast of North America had an incredibly dense and diverse and varied indigenous population. And as a result, we couldn't really tell the story of a type of tribe or a tribe or a specific nation. It had to be, in order to be meaningful, it had to be a story that weaves together lots of different people and communities. And I think there are other places in the nation where that would work. But there are also many places where it would be a bit more challenging, I think, to, I mean, I'm coming to you from North Carolina, and there are a few, there are a few narratives that dominate Native history out here, the Cherokee, the Lumbee, and then, you know, the Saponi and Sara, but the Cherokee and the Lumbee are the two that really dominate a lot of what people talk about. And so I imagine it'd be a little bit more difficult to do that here just because it's not as diverse or as dense, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing that maybe we could kind of inspire other writers to do as they kind of think through kind of regional or kind of state-based histories that, that center indigenous perspectives is the center land, right? That's kind of why we kind of titled the book "We Are the Land," right? In one sense, it kind of embodies the kind of one of the main arguments that we write in the book is that that California Indians possess a unique relationship to the land that is California. And on the other hand, I think it speaks to the way in which kind of ongoing systems of colonialism seek to divorce indigenous peoples from their homelands. And I think what the book strikes to do is to kind of discuss kind of that tension through kind of indigenous relationships with the land, with these kind of colonial policies that are intending to kind of divorce people from their homelands. So I think that's kind of a narrative that I think that could might kind of carry into other spaces.
I'm always curious about the process of writing a book, partially for selfish reasons, since I'm working on a book myself, and I'm always interested in getting tips on how to do it. But especially when a book is co-written like this, I'm curious about what that experience is like. Writing a book can often be a very solitary and a very personal process. So what was the experience like of co-writing a text for the two of you? What was that process like? And Willie, maybe we can hear from you first.
Yeah, it was kind of interesting as Damon mentioned. I mean, I think one of the reasons it was interesting is because this is not typically what historians do, right? Typically, historians kind of write single-authored books, like you just kind of mentioned, right? You're alone in either an archive doing the research, or you're alone in your office kind of doing the writing. But as Damon mentioned, I mean, we kind of hatched this idea at a conference. Kind of building on, I think, initially on our geographic strengths and what we do. So most of my research has tended to favor or be kind of located in Northern California. As Damon mentioned, his research kind of developed into, or was kind of focused in Southern California. And so we thought, given kind of the complexity of California Indian history, having kind of this north-south kind of focus, I think would be good for writing the book. But I think as over time, I mean, I think strengths developed over the course of the book that I think really kind of enhance the final product. I mean, my research kind of methodologies tend towards kind of using oral history and oral tradition, and I've focusing on kind of labor history and economic relations. Damon has done a fantastic job, I think, throughout the book, making sure that we thought about environmental history throughout every chapter, and also the visual eye that Damon brought to the book. He's the one who kind of hunted down and found the photograph that's on the cover of the book, and also kind of had a kind of keen eye on how maps would look and a lot of the kind of the visual sources that you see in the text. And as I've had kind of conversations with other people about the book as it's come out, it's that kind of the balance that I think that is struck in the book is something that stands out to a lot of the readers.
So my art history background and art background, survived in tiny ways. I think Willie laid it out really well. I don't have a lot to add there, just that we do work very differently. And I think it's interesting. It was a very interesting experience. And I could imagine, we haven't talked about this, Willie, but I could totally imagine a panel at some Western history conference or something on how to co-author a book, not just us, but others, us with others, because I think we could offer some interesting perspectives, given that we do come from a very different writing tradition or writing habits, I tend to start from the abstract and the, you know, elaborate and exaggerated and loopy and kind of gradually ground myself. And Willie tends to start from a really grounded part and then add complexity and to it. And we end up in the same place. It's just, we start in such opposite places that we recognize that early on, even from like, even down to the fact that I'm a one space after the period guy and Willie's a two space after the period guy. So we had to work hard to make it invisible. I think we've done a great job. There are passages that I can't remember who wrote, but we did it. We broke up the chapters after we'd conceptualized the whole thing together. There was a lot of abstract thinking and conceptualizing and periodization and organizing as part of the proposal. But once we laid out the chapters, we broke them up, divided them up, and then wrote and then gave them to the other person to edit. So we each would edit many times the other person's writing. And then as the editing became more severe and things were cut and moved, you know, those distinctions broke down in terms of whose chapter was which. And I think for the most part, we've accomplished that. We found a voice that remains steady throughout the text that comes from both of us. So I think we were successful in that, but it was a lot of Google Drive and a lot of Dropbox and all that.
Well, Damon, I will say that you have converted me to being a one space after a period person. So there you go.
Yes.
But also, I think it's been odd to kind of think about this process, especially in the last year after everyone's been kind of hunkered down because of the COVID-19 pandemic. We've been kind of teaching, you know, via Zoom or WebEx or some of these other kind of platforms. And it's almost, I mean, one of the things I kind of thought of is that Damon and I were kind of uniquely prepared to kind of do that kind of work, because as we were writing the book, you know, up even before the pandemic kind of hit, we would have kind of sometimes weekly, sometimes monthly kind of just phone conversations just about where we were with the writing, you know, what needed to be done in each chapter. I don't know how people could have kind of co-authored books kind of before kind of some of the advent of these kind of technologies that Damon kind of mentioned. Yes. that we're all using right now. I think we kind of hit a good moment where this kind of work is now kind of easy to do, this kind of co-authored things that is easy to do. And I do, Damon, I think as you were kind of alluding to, I think that historians should do more of this kind of co-author, yeah, this co-writing of texts. I think it's very kind of productive and worthwhile, I think.
Yeah, I can't imagine this book being, I could not imagine writing this book on my own. And I'm not sure that it was just so much work. It's not quite that. It was conceptually, it was so broad, but also just in terms of the thought process that continually had to go into it. We really benefited from having another set of eyes. One tip to listeners, if they did want to try to write a book together with somebody else, turn your notifications on so that anytime the other author updates a file in Dropbox or changes a file in Drive, you get a little ding on your phone or your computer, because it works as a really great kind of, I don't know, guilt reminder. Like, oh, Willie just updated the chapter. He's working. So then I would feel like I need to work too. And it really did make things visible, that when they're invisible, it's very easy to postpone until, you know, after the afternoon crisis of class or committee meeting or whatever.
And let the record show, I just checked inside the book and there is one space after every period. So I don't know if that was an editorial decision or if that's just a win in Damon's column or what, but just confirming that for everyone.
Well, actually what would happen is we would get to a certain point and then I would just select the entire text and do a find replace for any time there were two spaces after a period and just not tell Willie. And then periodically I do it again and again. And so his two spaces sort of disappeared, but then also once it got to the copy editor, they were going to kind of wash that stuff out anyway.
Right. So let's get into the content of the book a bit, and I want to first ask a question about structure, because there's an interesting move that you both make, where in between each of the, I guess you can call them main chapters, you intersperse these smaller sections about individual specific places such as Ukiah, I believe I'm pronouncing that right, and Los Angeles and Riverside and San Diego. What is the purpose of these subsections, and why include them as these standalone smaller chapters as you've done so? And Damon, maybe we could start with you.
Yeah, that's great. That was some of the aspects of the book were there all along. We knew that it would be chronologically organized. We had an idea of the kinds of maps that we wanted. I mean, some of it looks very much like how we envisioned it when we started. The vignettes came along a few years in to the process, because we had always been struggling with the thing I think any historian, any writer who's writing history struggles with, and that's how you conceptualize and organize your writing. I mean, we tend to default to chronology. Change over time is our, you know, it's our motto. But at the same time, we can organize things thematically, and we can organize things topically or spatially. And in this case, we knew there were issues and topics that cut against the chronology. And so we were trying to figure out how to do that. And the idea started out as a series of just kind of, I don't know, call outs. So it wasn't necessarily, when we first started thinking about it, spatial. We had this whole idea about the mission project and the way the missions had been remembered as an idea of something that really isn't just about the 1830s or the 1890s or the 1930s or the 1950s, but it stretches all the way across. And gradually those vignettes became increasingly spatially oriented. And we realized that's the thing that tied all this together. And that's the way we wanted to organize it. So we winnowed it down to 9 places, and we wanted the chronology to stop for a bit. And we wanted people to focus on a place so that they could see change over time in a concentrated way. They could see how all of California, one of the people who read an early manuscript said something along the lines of, isn't every space a native space? And we had to kind of formulate our response to say, yeah, every place is a native space, but in different ways. And so each of these locations that we've selected, their indigeneity, the indigenous people of the region, follow different paths, some similar over, you know, some sort of like some similar patterns, but yet the distinct ways the paths broke were important stories to be told. We wanted people to be able to look out the window. And you know, I lived in LA for a number of years, and so I could imagine how I would have treated the vignette on Los Angeles. I would have gone to some of these places and looked at them. And I, as a teacher, both a high school teacher in LA now at a smaller arts college, I want my students to get out and see what they're reading about. And doing those vignettes made it easier for us to imagine people doing that.
Yeah, I think the one thing I would add here is I think the vignettes also allow us to tell a story of continuity as much as kind of change over time. I think a lot of times people kind of think about American Indian history as being only kind of focusing on the ways in which Europeans and Americans disrupted and overthrew kind of indigenous lives, and that's an important story. I think there's you know, a lot of historical evidence for that kind of narrative in that story. But I do think that sometimes it's important to kind of step back and look at kind of the continuities that exist for kind of indigenous peoples. And I thought that place becomes a kind of a good way to kind of to make that argument, or to kind of to trace that over time. Is that, yes, there's a lot of things that happen, like in a place like Ukiah, like indigenous peoples are dispossessed of land. There's a variety of policies that are there to kind of that seek to kind of separate Pomo people, the indigenous people of that area, from their lands. But Pomo people were there at creation. They were there throughout the systems of colonization. They're there now, and they'll continue to be on their homelands into the near future. And so I think kind of being able to try to trace that continuity, I think, was helpful through using these vignettes as well.
There's a lot of material packed into this book. We're not going to have time to talk about all of it. You cover, you know, many centuries worth of history in a book of around 300 or so pages. But I think it's worthwhile to start at the beginning, to start with beginnings. Can you talk a bit about the importance of stories about place to the Native people who lived in that place that would eventually become California? You make the connection, I think, between place and storytelling and identity very clear in this book.
Yeah, I think as you're kind of noting, I think one of the kind of the complicated parts of writing a book like this is that we really tried to tell a story, you know, one could say from creation, from indigenous creation to casinos, and now actually to beyond casinos, right? Into the, we're getting into the 21st century. And then, so we, in order to kind of write that kind of book and to make those kind of emphases, we centered indigenous creation stories and other oral traditions in that kind of first chapter. And we do so because we want to kind of privilege indigenous ways of knowing. And I think by looking at creation stories or and other oral traditions that, that come from California Indian nations, California Indian communities, we're able to kind of focus on relationships to the land and then as well as then other human actors that take a that act in creation stories and in oral traditions. And then I think in this way, land becomes kind of important because as articulated in oral histories and oral traditions, people are literally kind of people of a place, meaning that the names that indigenous peoples have for themselves often translate into people of a place. And so the name for a native nation in Northern California is called the Yuki people. That's the name for themselves is Ukonom, which translates into people of the valley, right? So that kind of situates them in a specific land and the specific place that at which they were created. And I think one of the kind of the effective ways that we do this is by privileging indigenous kind of oral traditions and creation stories and that sort of thing. We're not kind of telling a story of indigenous kind of colonization or the way in which kind of Europeans and Americans colonize indigenous peoples, but we're kind of telling a story of kind of indigenous creation stories and how indigenous nations have kind of grown from their creation.
And how did California's native people encounter Europeans during the initial years of meeting and early colonization? It's not the kind of simple story of a single moment, as it is often told in, you know, that's certainly how I learned it in elementary school and, you know, in a lot of sort of mainstream historical mythmaking, but that's not really how it went.
Right, right. And I think that part of that has to do with California's uniqueness. I mean, this was a diverse, multivalent world with lots of different people. When we were describing this and writing about it, we thought about it a lot as a very dynamic place with a lot of pulsing relationships. You know, we're thinking about it as trade goods and ideas and languages and people moving from group to group, from community to community. So that when the Europeans arrived, they were not walking into a world. I mean, I think like you pointed out, we often, certainly in the past, we've always seen in the mainstream history, the indigenous people depicted as though they're living in a state of nature, a kind of simplistic ignorance waiting for Europeans to arrive. Or, you know, worse yet, like literally sitting on the beach, twiddling their thumbs, and yawning, waiting for the Europeans to get there so that the party can start, you know, and that image of the European arrival being the moment when things start, we really had to push back against. We wanted to illustrate that this was a world that was vibrant and existed and thrived on its own. And European entrances into that were dramatic, but they weren't the kind of dramatic encounter that we often see where once this person arrives on the beach, everything changes. Clearly things did change. Disease, found a ready home in those pulsing networks of, you know, trade networks and other things. So disease traveled much faster than Europeans and had a real impact. But we wanted to make sure that it was seen as Europeans trying to fit in or accommodate themselves to, or indigenous people seeking to integrate some aspects of European life into their own ways. Like an example from the book that we use, the Kumeyaay in San Diego, there's an account of from one of the Spanish colonizers that writes about how these people are so simple. They came to help us haul in our fishing, and then we gave them some as a kind of a reward. And it's clear that's not at all what's happening. This is fishing on the shares, right? This is the Kumeyaay watching and saying, you know, we want to make sure that we get what is due us if we're going to let you fish in our water. And that is an example of what I think we were trying to do throughout, is to depict the encounter from the other side or from the other sides in ways that made it legible to people. There were reasons that indigenous people wanted to work with Europeans, and there were obviously many reasons why they did not, and in ways that they resisted.
But were a word that comes up a lot in this book, well, a couple words actually that come up a lot in this book, and one you just mentioned, Damon, are words like adaptation and resiliency. And over the course of the 17th and the 18th centuries, you have several European empires that are attempting to exert control on the place that was beginning to be called California. And through all of that, you have indigenous people in the region who are demonstrating this resiliency. So what adaptations and what forms of resistance did Native people along the Pacific demonstrate, particularly as the Spanish government was trying to impose the famous or maybe infamous mission system along the California coast?
Yeah, this was one of the kind of the more challenging sections of the book to write. And I think one of the reasons why it was kind of challenging is that kind of the Spanish period is one of the most kind of well-documented and written about time periods in California history. If you go to California, as you just mentioned, Steve, right, is that there's missions have been preserved. They're kind of part of the ways in which kind of California kind of thinks of itself and its identity. Historians have documented and discussed kind of the development of what has been called the Spanish fantasy past as a way of not for non-Indigenous Californians to develop an identity for themselves in the state, but also kind of for more material reasons to attract tourists to Southern California, principally, and that sort of thing. And so we I think one of the kind of things we try to do out in the sections, what we do throughout the book, I think, right, is to try to kind of balance a story of colonialism at these Spanish missions, right? So these missions, we see kind of the forced conversion of indigenous peoples to Catholicism, the spread of crowd diseases, which leads to kind of widespread depopulation of indigenous peoples along the California coast, the introduction of labor relations and slavery into indigenous communities. And then we wanted to kind of balance those stories with stories of, as you kind of mentioned, of resistance and resiliency on the part of indigenous peoples. And so indigenous peoples kind of might blend indigenous and Christian religious icons, such there's a painting at Mission San Luis Rey, for instance, that blends kind of Chumash religious iconography with Spanish religious kind of icons. Actually, we had an event last night we had a virtual event last night, and Damon pointed out is that in our chapter on the Spanish missions, there's a picture of indigenous peoples at Mission San Francisco playing a hand game or a game. And then like almost 100 pages later, we have a picture of indigenous peoples playing hand game, different group of indigenous peoples playing a different hand game up in Northern California outside the Grandstone Rancheria. These practices on the part of indigenous Californians kind of even are maintained and continued, even though these kind of colonial systems are kind of impinging on their lives. And we also kind of talk about resistance, everyday forms of resistance, such as kind of avoiding work, to like a more widespread kind of acts of resistance, such as running away and even the killing of Spanish priests. And this, I think this kind of focus on runaways also convinced us that we needed to look outside the missions. I think too often, right, this California Indian history during this kind of the Spanish period is seen only through the prism of the mission, as if that's the only place that California Indians were kind of living and having kind of an experience with. And so we wanted to situate ourselves in the story outside the missions and examine how California Indians kind of kept the missions and Spanish colonists at arm's length, either by kind of allowing runaways to incorporate into their communities, maybe kind of trading for goods, but still not kind of engaging with the Spanish in a lot of ways. And so I think we were kind of able kind of, again, to kind of balance these two different kind of perspectives that seem to kind of shape how people understand California's past.
I would just add that if you want to look at those two pages, that's page 78 and page 169. And due to the happenstance of the layout of the book, you can open the book to both pages and see the images side by side if you just take the intervening 100 pages and sort of hold it up.
Little experiment.
And as you're pointing out, you know, the importance of continuity along with change. And as you said, one of you said before, you know, as historians, we peddle in change over time, right? It's what we look at. But as much as things change, you know, often you have these threads that just run through the past. And that's a perfect example of that, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
So again, speaking, you know, thinking about what historians do and how historians think about the past, I feel as though often people who write and think deeply about history were kind of resistant to thinking about, like, you know, particular moments as like, oh, this is when everything changed, right? That the past is too complicated, that there is, you know, too many factors that lead to any one event, that we tend to bristle against this kind of bookmark style of history. Yet, all that said, the 1840s in California are really a moment of pretty massive and important changes. So can you talk a little bit about the 1840s and their aftermath? What changes for California's native people after 1846, going into 1848 and 49 and 1850? Can you explain the changing relationship between indigenous people in California and Americans specifically, and why and how this relationship came to be characterized by what is increasingly seen and recognized as really genocidal violence?
Yeah, absolutely. And the first thing I think to say is to echo your last bit there, that this is a genocide. There's no question in anybody's mind who studies this seriously. Even Governor Newsom has flirted around the language. He's avoided saying it exactly, but he's used the adjective genocidal to describe what he just described as violence. So it's kind of a bad, but it's genocide. It fits all the definitions. And so, yeah, we did struggle with this, and from a standpoint of the writing, because this was a moment where things dramatically changed. And so much has been written about it. We needed to present that, but we also didn't want that to weigh so heavily in the narrative that it contributed to a pattern that we've seen. And the pattern tends to be that there's the missions, and then there's the gold rush and the genocidal violence that came about as a result. And those are almost like two suns with a U that make it hard to see what happened right around it, like, and block out the shadows and the spaces in between. So in order to answer the question about what happened, I think we sort of have to go back a little before 1846, because the 1840s was characterized by a kind of liminal status. The missions had been secularized, and the indigenous people had been, quote, emancipated, and a variety of different patterns emerged. Some people remained near the missions and continued to work in agriculture and sort of maintain the missions as a place, not a religious place as much. Many others took what they could and left. It's a period of rampant horse theft. And that's something that shows up in the literature consistently, is that Native people are coming in and taking what they need, and in many cases, taking what they produced. So that's the period of the 1840s. The war comes into that. The Mexican-American War occurs in that context, and the United States wins the war quite easily in terms of its military power, and followed almost immediately by settlers. And I think that the big change here is that once American settlers came in, driven at first in low numbers by the war and the prospect for business, but then obviously, as I think everyone knows, in massive numbers after the widespread dissemination of the discovery of gold, the 49ers, so to speak, a term that itself erases things, right? Like the first wave of miners and settlers were there in 48, but yet, you know, we talk about the 49ers because that's when the white people arrived. And so that period when Americans, among others, but predominantly Americans, began to arrive and mine, brought a level of genocidal violence into a system of settler colonialism that was able to tap right into existing trade and existing communication networks. So violence goes into that and ricochet radiates out into the hinterlands. The effect is, I think, pretty well known, but just to kind of reiterate, you know, the population of indigenous people in California prior to European arrival is estimated anywhere between, you know, the numbers are pretty vast. 700,000, 1 million, 300,000. It's all, they're a lot of people.
But it's clear
that by 1850, there's somewhere around 150,000 indigenous people. And by 1900, there's somewhere around 15,000. So the violence that occurs has a direct impact on the lives of indigenous people. And it's simply put, it's that they were in the way of the kind of land use that Americans envisioned. They wanted to turn the land into a commodity, and indigenous people were literally in the way of that effort, and were dealt with astonishing violence.
If I could ask one follow-up to that question, you know, among people who know the story, as you said, there's really no debate that this was a genocide in California. And yeah, as you also said, you have the governor of California who, you know, kind of dances around the subject. Why do you think there is this disconnect between those people who know the story, who know the truth about what happened, and yet people, you know, with power to maybe with an outside voice or an outside role in shaping how people think about these things? Why is there this resistance to you know, talking about this in a way that is honest and reflects the reality?
I think there's a couple reasons. One is I think that the story of westward expansion, manifest destiny, that's a mythology that still works for a lot of people. It still accomplishes what it set out to do, which was to deliver the possession of the United States to their ancestors in a way that justifies their presence. And I think there's a lot of people who just don't really want to question that. In the same way, there's a lot of Southerners who don't really want to question the lost cause, or, you know, these mythologies still do work, even if they're wrong. They still do some sort of mythological work. The other thing is, I think there's, you know, I'm not an attorney. I don't speak law, but at the same time, I think there are some real risks for state officials or federal officials to label this a genocide, because it is almost certainly going to embolden claims from descendants. And I think there's a kind of let's just smooth off the edges and say things were bad in the past, you know, like what I teach my students, but I can't remember the journalist's name who described the passive voice as the past exonerative, right? That, like, bad things happen, mistakes were made, you know, but not take ownership for who did that and why. So I think that's also a part of it. It just really brings on some responsibility that I think some federal or state officials aren't ready to accept.
Mm-hmm. Power and restitution. It sounds like a really kind of the prime factors. Yeah.
So Willie,
I'll turn to you for this question. And in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, in the aftermath of the tumultuous and violent and horrific mid-19th century, you start to see wage work become another way that both Americans are attempting to colonize California and colonize indigenous people in California. But it's more complicated than that. It also becomes a means for those same people to resist colonialism. So can you tell us a little bit about the allotment era, as it's often known, and the importance of changing forms of labor and of work in particular at the turn of the century in California?
Yeah, I think this is a kind of, this moment in time was, I think, vitally important for California Indian people and California Indian communities. I think it's the ways in which kind of California Indian people kind of rebuilt their lives in the aftermath of kind of the genocidal violence that Damon had just kind of had talked about. And so allotment, in case anyone doesn't know, right, was a policy of kind of distributing formerly kind of communal land holdings on reservations, right, to heads of households. And so the goal of allotment policy was to assimilate American Indians into the body politic, into the national politic as private property landholders. And the goal there, right, was on one hand to break up communal held lands on reservations, but also to break up tribal identities. And so on one hand, like, the story of allotment is a story of horrendous land dispossession, the loss of lands all across the United States. I believe American Indians across the United States lost 70% of their land base between, say, 1887, when allotment was passed, and 1934, when allotment was finally ended. And when I teach classes, I always kind of emphasize this kind of long point about the devastating and the crippling impact of allotment, and the way in which allotment has produced kind of modern kind of indigenous poverty. And so I think, you know, when Damon was kind of talking about kind of why don't people want to recognize genocide, I think that often people don't want to kind of recognize how the past continues to affect the present. In much the same way, kind of the genocidal policies of the 19th century are affecting, affecting California Indian lives today, so do these kind of policies of land dispossession and allotment affect indigenous peoples in California and indigenous peoples throughout the rest of the United States. But in addition to kind of land dispossession being a kind of an enormous problem for Native peoples in California, In California, allotments were often incredibly small, right? So on the plains, for instance, allotments were sometimes between 160 and 320 acres, right? That 160 acres was a reflective of, you know, the Homestead Act, one of those kind of, as Damon was mentioning, kind of that mythology of westward expansion and so forth, like the Homestead Act. It's kind of wrapped up into that, and that granting 160 acres of land to farmers. But on some reservations, land allotments were between 5 and 10 acres of land. And if the goal of allotment policy, as warped as it was to kind of promote kind of family farming to American Indians, there were no way that American Indian families could survive on 5 to 10 acres of land in California, right? The nation had kind of moved beyond the kind of the use of such small land plots. And so throughout California, indigenous peoples kind of turned to wage labor. And Damon and I, in both in kind of previous work, have discussed the ways in which kind of indigenous peoples kind of become migrant farm workers. Where I'm from in Northern California, people went out into the fields and they picked picked hops, picked grapes, and those kind of activities. Indigenous peoples kind of worked as cowboys. They worked on infrastructure projects such as irrigation canals. And so there, you see kind of this widespread kind of wage labor activity throughout California that is being perpetuated by indigenous peoples. And I think that this is actually kind of an important point that I think people need to kind of recognize. I think in the present day, when people think about American Indians, they think about them as being unemployed. And that's kind of a product of more kind of recent historical developments. And if we kind of look back to the late 19th and early 20th century, we see kind of a rich and robust kind of experiences of indigenous peoples working in a variety of kind of activities throughout the state of California. But I think one of the kind of the neat things that work and labor does for California Indian communities is that it meant much more than kind of earning a wage that was important for families to survive. You know, that's obviously kind of the economic importance of wage labor was significant and vital, that helped families kind of get through the late 19th and early 20th century. But it was also kind of wage labor was a political act. As California Indians moved to reservations, sometimes they chose to do so. Sometimes they were forced there against their will. Indigenous California Indians experienced a considerable amount of surveillance. Reservation agents, the people who were the federal government put in charge of reservations, surveilled and watched every aspect of California Indian lives. They tried to control American Indian economies, their families, sexuality. All aspects of California Indian lives were watched and monitored. And so when California Indians left reservations to go work as migrant farm workers, for instance, if only temporarily, if only kind of a few weeks, they escaped the gaze of the federal government and kind of lived lives as they were wanting to do. And they were able to participate in activities that the Office of Indian Affairs and the federal government didn't want them to participate. So, you know, we were been kind of talking about kind of hand game and these kind of gambling games that California Indians have been playing throughout their history. Well, on reservations, agents didn't want them playing these games. They thought they were detrimental and demoralizing to California Indian people. But California Indian peoples wanted to continue to play them. There were ways to kind of socialize and get in contact with one another and kind of create community and family throughout. While kind of these federal policies were seeking to kind of dispossess them and separate them from land and other people. I remember I interviewed someone about this a couple of years ago, and she recalled that after a kind of a long day of people kind of doing farm work and picking hops, for instance, in Northern California, she would follow her dad at night and they would play grass game. They would, you know, play one of these gambling games late into the night. I don't know how they did it, right? Migrant farm workers, hard work. I don't know how you kind of work all day and then get prepared to play gambling games. But she would remember that she would lay on her dad's back while he was playing these games, and that's how she would almost fall asleep every night, right? So her kind of experiences that she had was kind of her memory was going to kind of do this farm work, but also kind of thinking about kind of her own relationship with her father. As he was kind of engaging with this kind of building community with other Native people at the during work and then after work, but I think we also see kind of efforts of indigenous Californians to mold allotment policy to their own ends. And so, on the Hoopa Valley Reservation, for instance, in far northern California, Hoopas ensured that all allotments, at least initially, ensure that everyone had access to the Trinity River. And so even given this kind of policy that is seeking to dispossess indigenous peoples of their lands, indigenous peoples were able to kind of mold this kind of these activities to make sure that everyone kind of had equitable access to resources, including kind of, again, kind of access to the river, which was important economically and spiritually for Hoopa people, as well as other resources on and near their reservation.
One thing I would add to that was just a piece from
some testimony
in a court case that I had read, and one of the farmers from Southern California was complaining about the size of the allotments, and he described it, I thought, just very, very, you know, clearly as too small to provide grazing for horses, and not big enough to justify having a tractor, because the tractor was so expensive. And so you really couldn't work it either way, because if you were working the land with horses, you had to pay to feed them. There wasn't even enough grazing land, but yet you couldn't possibly afford a tractor because the land wouldn't support that kind of economic production. And this was one of many, many complaints about the size of the allotments.
So the beginning of the 20th century marks a new era of resistance in all kinds of ways. But among these is the founding of new organizations, some of which were led by Eastern whites, but others were organized and were led by indigenous California activists themselves. So what roles did activist groups play in California during the middle decades of the 20th century, jumping ahead a little bit? And how do they bring together all kinds of different threads of resistance and issues relating to citizenship and self-governance and sovereignty, and even up to the Red Power movement and moment in the 1960s and 1970s?
So, yeah, that's a really great question. And I think part of what's interesting about it is that by the middle decades of the 20th century, most of the major activist groups, Indian activist groups in California, were helmed by Indians. And I think that's something that has its own story. Late 19th century, there were a lot of so-called friends of the Indians. They called themselves the Friends of the Indians. Sometimes they capitalized the F because they were Quakers. Maybe sometimes they capitalized the F because they thought they were important, but they definitely did think that their help was what was going to save indigenous people, and they rushed to their aid. And beginning in that moment and carrying through all the way till the middle of the 20th century, California Indian peoples tended to look at that as like, yeah, sure, we'll accept parts of your help, but we're going to, you know, put that toward the goals that we have. And so it was a very tense kind of cooperation in which non-Indians would raise awareness of Indian problems, would help raise money in some cases, but often Native people were happy to take what worked for them and turn it to their own advantage. And that really carried through in the late 19th and into early 20th century. And out of that come the two first major organizations, the Mission Indian Federation and the Brotherhood of the Brotherhood, the Collet organization that came out of Northern California. Both of those were white people, Frederick Collet and his wife, and Jonathan Tibbett, a real estate aspirant, a developer that was in was trying in Riverside, and they organized these groups with the idea that they would in some way benefit personally from organizing Indians. And some have pointed to those groups as not legitimate in some case in the past, certainly because they were led by whites, and that the whites in many cases, certainly in the case of Collet, were wildly corrupt. But in the case of, say, the Mission Indian Federation, their membership grew to thousands, and Jonathan Tibbett was the only white person involved, and it became fairly easy for the organization to function in the way it wanted without his, he's a figurehead that helped, raise money and such. But those organizations became very powerful and took off in different directions. In the case of the Northern California, a lot of the Native people who were active in that organization ended up forming their own organization in the 1920s, and that grew into a number of different organizations in the 1940s that were solely led by California Indians. And in the South, the Federation continued into the early 1960s, but really took a cantankerous, maybe is the way to say it, approach. They turned towards some kind of of reactionary politics. But I think that that middle decade of the 20th century, in which you have statewide or at least very large regional organizations that are engaging in lawsuits and testifying before Congress and fighting the termination bills and all sorts of things, lay the foundation for what happens in the 1960s that we often think of as the Red Power movement. We thought a lot about how to deal with Alcatraz, because the Alcatraz occupation in 1969 is one of the most iconic California Indian stories, despite the fact that in some ways it's not really a California Indian story. It's a Native American story that happens in California. And so we wanted to make sure that we structured the book in such a way that people understood where that came from and also where it went. And many of the people who were involved, who were from California, had come out of a tradition where their parents or uncles or grandparents, even in some cases, had been very, very active. Ed Castillo, who was one of the original occupiers, was, I believe, the Willie, help me out. Wasn't Adam Castillo his uncle?
Yeah,
I think. So yeah, so he grew up in that milieu of early 20th century, mid 20th century Indian activism, and so this was not strange to him. It's just a different kind of iteration of it.
So I think
that's how we understood the California Indian participation in the Alcatraz occupation as coming from, and then we traced that back into places like the Pitt River occupation in 1970 to show how Alcatraz is not an island in the famous phrase. Alcatraz is just one example of a long standing tradition of California Indian activism that continued after that.
And then you spend the last couple chapters of the book detailing some of the more recent past in the history of California's indigenous history. And they're two really well written and fairly long chapters. And we've been talking for about an hour, so I'm not going to ask either of you to go over each of them in detail. But I was hoping that maybe you could tell a couple stories of the recent past of California's indigenous history that maybe help explain the present moment of bit. Where do the themes that you present in this book stand today?
Yeah, I think that there's a couple of ways we can do this. I mean, I think one of the things that we did in the book, we tried to make the book as current as possible, meaning that we finished writing the book about a year ago when the nation kind of locked down because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And so we were able to kind of include examples of how indigenous people shaped and responded to the pandemic in the book. For instance, right around, I think, April of last year, a Native nation in Northern California held a jump dance, which is part of the kind of a world renewal ceremony, which is intended to kind of restore balance to the world. And so they performed the ceremony to kind of restore the balance that we were all, the imbalanced world in which we were all living because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And then I think another kind of story that kind of popped out to me as we were doing this is, I remember there was when San Francisco kind of went into lockdown and no one was on the streets anymore, there were stories about coyote wandering the streets of San Francisco. And in Ohlone oral tradition, coyote is one of their creator figures. And it was striking to me to kind of think through the ways in which kind of coyote was there at the creation of the Bay Area, of what we understand about the Bay Area, and then is here back kind of walking around the streets everyone was asked to kind of stay at home. And I think that these stories kind of talk about kind of the revitalization of California Indian people in the 20th and 21st centuries. And in part, we did center kind of on Indian gaming, right? The explosion of Indian gaming in Southern California has bolstered indigenous economies. So much so that the San Manuel Band of located in Southern California just bought a resort casino near the Las Vegas Strip, right? Where I'm at right now. And so I think that kind of that there's a kind of an economic and then kind of a cultural revitalization becomes of that. So one of the things that we kind of talk about in the book is the ways in which the explosion of Indian gaming has allowed people to return to reservations. So there's been always a policy of kind of getting, like with allotment, to get Native peoples off reservations. Well, one of the examples from Indian gaming is that they're able to kind of come back to reservations and return to homelands. And so we see this with non-gaming tribes too. The Hoopas, for instance, have revitalized women's coming of age ceremonies in Round Valley, where I'm from. We, beginning in the 1990s, we began to hold an event called the Gnome Cult Walk, in which we retrace the route people took during an ethnic cleansing that had happened during the American Civil War. And so we kind of commemorate and rethink some of these kind of these kind of historical events. And so I think that there are things that we could have covered a little bit more in the book. You know, I think the rise of the land back movement, for instance, within the last year, I think those things all kind of point to kind of the continuing vitality of indigenous peoples in California, kind of building on the point that Damon made a couple of minutes ago about Alcatraz not being an island, but kind of this kind of long history of indigenous activism that it'll continue as we, even after this book is published and going into the 21st century.
So for one of my final questions, I'll pose this to each of you in turn. I'm always curious, as sort of a summary question, if there's one takeaway that you hope readers come away from your book understanding when they put it down for the final time, when they reach the last page, what would you hope that that would be? And Damon, why don't we start with you?
It's always a challenge to get to winnow it down to one. But I think that the thing that I would want people to take away, maybe I don't even have a word for it, but the ongoing nature of this story,
as much as it's important
to show that California Indians are still here, because there's still a widespread belief that either all Indians have just disappeared in face of, you know, modern society, or if people are a little bit more aware that the genocide in California worked and that the Indians are gone. So that's still a very widespread perception. And so it's very critical that we continually point out California Indians are still here. They're thriving. They're growing. But the other part of that kind of ongoing nature here is that the settler colonial structures that were put in place are ongoing. So it's not just that California Indians are still here, but we, and in my case, non-native, are still engaging in colonial practices. So it's not even that Indians survived colonialism and now we can talk about it. It's that Native people are around and we're still colonizing, but in a different way.
I think that's
a really important a lesson for people to take away, is that we're still in it. It's still happening. And that can play out, one, in the way people choose to act. We can engage in settler harm reduction or policies, but it also helps make a little more sense of the land back movement that Willie just mentioned. This is ongoing. This is still an open-ended question.
Yeah, I think I think I would build on that. Is that I think that the one thing that I want readers to take from the book is California has been an indigenous space. It is an indigenous space, and it will be an indigenous space going into the future.
And then finally, I always like to get a preview from my guests about what projects they are currently working on. Sometimes when a book is so recently out, it feels sort of like an engagement in sort of a almost wishful thinking, right? Like, this is what I'm planning to be working on in the future. But nonetheless, you know, as historians, we always have a few projects that we're working on. So what are each of you working on now?
Yes, I think over the summer, one of the projects I'm working with a graduate student with whom I'm working to discuss the relationship between indigenous peoples in southern Nevada to the Colorado River, and then talk about how the Hoover Dam was one way in which that relationship was kind of undermined and thwarted. And then also maybe on a kind of a larger project, I'm interested in the way in which kind of Maidu and Konkau people in Northern California, including my ancestors, right, use kind of mobility and movement to kind of enlarge and reshape their worlds. And so having kind of a similar structure, kind of beginning with creation stories and thinking through mobility there, and carrying through about how Konkau mobility kind of helps to kind of create what we understand to be kind of a modern United States.
And I think with any writing project like this, anybody who's engaged in it knows that so much ends up edited out, you know, that you have to cut. And so some of the projects I'm working on are things that they were my precious, you know, Jorge Luis Borges calls editing killing your children. So these are my precious babies that got cut from the book. And I'm kind of trying to think about ways to treat those differently. And then another project, the one that I'm mainly focusing on, came out of
the discovery
about, I mentioned it slightly earlier, how much the mission period and the gold rush period blind us to what happened between them. So I'm at the very beginning stages of a project that looks at California history from, say, 1836 or 37 or 38 to 1848. So literally, you know, I'm not going to talk about the gold rush and I'm not going to talk about the mission period. We're going to blind ourselves to that and just see what was going on in that 10, 12 year period in between, particularly focusing on the ways Native people were active in the transition of the state.
Those both sound like fantastic projects, and I'll have you both on the show individually when those come out, hopefully in the not too distant future.
Yeah,
hopefully.
Hopefully, that's right, hopefully.
That's the hope, right? Damon Akins is an associate professor of history at Guilford College, and William J. Bauer Jr. is a professor of history at UNLV. And together, they are the co-authors of We Are the Land, a history of Native California, which is just out, just came out earlier this year in 2021 from the University of California Press. Thank you both so much for writing this book and for speaking with me today. It's been fun.
Thank you, Stephen. It's been really great.
Thanks, Stephen. It's been great. Thank you so much.